This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So I'm excited to speak with you today because I'm going to hopefully give you kind of a different angle on our perspective of autism genetics. And that angle is a clinical one. And hopefully by the end of this talk, you'll be better equipped to answer the question that many of our parents ask, which is, what's the point of getting genetic testing? How is it going to actually help my child rather than just help the researchers? And I think we're sort of developing ways to answer that. Really, the focus of my research and the research in our autism center is focused on really getting to a place of personalized medicine or targeted interventions where we don't just say, you have autism, now go out and get whatever a regional center can afford to give you or what your insurance covers, really. Rather, we want to be at a point in autism and other neurodevelopmental disorders where we can, based on the child's genetic background and other related phenotypes and biomarkers, say, this is the profile your child fits into. Here are the right intervention strategies for your child. So that's really the framework in which we are thinking about these disorders. I always now start with my acknowledgement slide because I invariably run out of time. So just want to thank all of the collaborators. And at the end, I'll sort of mention specific people. But a lot of the work I'll describe today is really tremendous efforts from our people at the UCLA Center for Autism Research and Treatment. I also collaborate very closely with folks here in the Division of Child Neurology, particularly Joyce Wu, who's done a lot of the work with me on the tuberous sclerosis study. And then I work collaboratively with several folks around the country who study Dup15q syndrome. And we have a national alliance for this rare disorder. My work is funded by several NIH Autism Center of Excellence grants, as well as a K, and the Department of Defense actually funds our tuberous sclerosis research. And just my disclosure, I consult for Roche. Okay, so we're going to start. I am going to give you a little clinical overview of autism and really focus on the problem of heterogeneity, the fact that it is a heterogeneous disorder that often baffles us in many ways. And then I'll talk about genetics in the context of how we might use genetics to approach that clinical heterogeneity. And then I'll end with two examples of how we're thinking about heterogeneity in specific genetic syndromes, and those are tuberous sclerosis complex and Dup15q syndrome. Okay, so as you all know, autism is a neurodevelopmental disorder. It now sits in the chapter of neurodevelopmental disorders in DSM-5. These disorders, and they're listed there, are all heterogeneous conditions, and they're characterized by a delay or disturbance in the acquisition of skills, right? And those skills could be in motor, social, language, or cognition. What's really key here is that these are highly comorbid disorders, and a diagnosis of one does not preclude the diagnosis of another, which actually was not the case in DSM-4. So that is sort of a new diagnostic reality now, which sort of makes things, I think, more accurate, but sometimes more challenging. So as you know, in DSM-4, autism was diagnosed by this triad of impairments: impaired language or communication, impaired social interaction, and the presence of repetitive behaviors and restricted interests. In DSM-5, those two categories were actually combined, communication and social interaction, into one. And that new category is now aptly titled impaired social communication function. Why is that? Well, this is much more really accurate in terms of the way we think developmentally about social communication. So in infancy and early toddlerhood, communication is not just language, right? It's not just spoken words. It's nonverbal communication. It's gesturing. It's eye contact. All of those are ways to communicate, and they're critical for the development of social cognition. And so it was felt by the committee of DSM-5 that those two categories really made more sense to be combined. So I'm giving you the list here of, in DSM, of the criteria within those two domains, really to emphasize the fact that this is a list of symptoms, right? We are dealing with a list of behaviors and impairments. And so the way to get to this list is very, very wide and broad, right? It's not that there's one cause that can cause these list of symptoms. So just to round out the DSM-5 piece, the other sort of pieces in DSM-5 that are important for autism is that the symptoms need to be present in the early developmental period. So rather than there being a strict cutoff of these symptoms have to be present by age 3, which used to be the case, now they just need to be present in early development. And that actually kind of appreciates the fact that we're diagnosing a lot more adults with autism, and sometimes we don't remember exactly when the symptoms occurred. These symptoms have to limit everyday functioning. And this last one is key for, as we talk about the genetics, is that they cannot be better explained by intellectual disability. Now, that's challenging because sometimes by the time you see a child, both are there. And to really try to figure out, well, are these social communication deficits rooted in cognitive impairment and global delay is challenging. And I think it's something that we as clinicians think a lot about, particularly in these high-risk neurogenetic syndromes. And again, here I just list kind of the main changes. The other ones that I didn't mention besides the categories being combined is that, as I'm sure many of you know now, that's the categories that were defined in DSM-IV, namely Asperger, PDD-NOS, are sort of now subsumed under the spectrum of ASD. And I have a whole talk on sort of DSM-5 changes. We won't get into it. But I will say that those labels were really felt to not have a lot of diagnostic specificity and really seem to relate more to level of functioning. And so now in DSM-5, we talk about level of functioning based on IQ and adaptive impairment or functioning and not based on these categories. And importantly for us as clinicians, we can diagnose comorbid ADHD now, which is key because those comorbidities are very common. Okay, so as I said, there's clinical heterogeneity of autism, right? And so we think about the spectrum, and there's some real roots of this heterogeneity. One is intellectual functioning, right? So intellectual disability is common and ranges from mild to severe, and up to 70% of children. Language is an area that we focus a lot on in our studies in our autism center, using electrophysiology and other methods to think about language ability. But up to 30% of children on the spectrum remain minimally verbal. And a lot of our research that I won't talk about today is really focused on how do we figure out who will gain language and what are the pathways to language deficits. Epilepsy, for many in the room who take care of children with epilepsy, is also quite common. Up to 15% of children with an ASD diagnosis have epilepsy, but up to 50 to 60% have some baseline EEG abnormalities that might be an interesting biomarker into subgroups. Psychiatric comorbidities are very common. Sleep impairment, which I'm feeling very strongly today, is also very common. Up to 80% of children have some sort of insomnia, which essentially just means an inability or lack of sleep. And then the motor and sensory pieces are really key. And I'm listing these out. Some of these may be obvious to you. I'm listing these out because these come up when we see some of these children with high-risk genetic syndromes. So the motor impairment is not part of the diagnostic criteria, but as many of the neurologists in the room will probably agree with me, they probably should be and might be over time. But many children on the spectrum have motor impairment, be it just a motor delay in early development or something more measurable like hypotonia or even sometimes in coordination. The sensory piece is something that is now in the DSM-5 criteria under the repetitive behaviors restricted interests category. And the sensory impairment can be either hypo or hyperreactivity to sensory stimuli. And again, for those of you who know autism, which I'm assuming all of you in the room do, sensory issues can be a major problem. Children can be very averse to certain stimuli, and it can really affect their functioning. What the root of that is and what the effective interventions for those are an area of much interest in the research area. But there's also another sort of type of clinical heterogeneity, which is what I'm going to sort of try to get you guys to think about today, which is that there's heterogeneity in the social communication skills themselves, right? So based on a child's language ability, based on certain nonverbal communication abilities, like the ability to initiate joint attention or respond to joint attention, things like social motivation. So how motivated is a child to actually interact? Is the deficit in an interest in social interaction, or is the deficit in an ability to know how to interact appropriately? These may seem like subtle differences, but these are the type of behaviors and domains that we're really trying to tap into in the autism field, because that's where we're going to target appropriate interventions, is when we figure those little nuances out. And that, again, is sort of the framework in which those two types of heterogeneities is the framework in which I really look at these high-risk syndromes. So in the field now, the effort is really focused on defining clinically meaningful, etiology-based, hopefully, homogeneous subgroups within the spectrum in order to design more targeted interventions, right? Unfortunately, right now, we're still at this kind of one-size-fits-all approach. And as you know, the suit doesn't fit the ostrich and the elephant in the same way. And so we want to be able to start tailoring our interventions more appropriately to the needs of the child. So one way to do that is to think about the genetics, and that's sort of the second part of this talk, right? So Dan Geschwind and I wrote a piece on this earlier this year where we talked about kind of disentangling the heterogeneity of autism through genetic findings, and I'll sort of unwrap that a little bit for you in the next few minutes. But just to sort of talk about the genetics, and I see some of my genetics experts in the room here, so tell me later if I say something incorrect, but I've learned a lot actually working with people like Dr. Martinez and Dr. Crandall over the last couple of years here. But we know that ASD is heritable. That's been known since the first reported cases, right? It's actually one of the most heritable neuropsychiatric disorders. The concordance rate in monozygotic twins is up to 70%, so not 100%, but more heritable than, again, some other disorders. The concordance in dizygotic twins goes down. Now, if you look at what we call the broader autism phenotype, meaning having some traits that are autistic, if you will, meaning either some obsessive compulsive behaviors or just some social atypicality, social anxiety, then that rate goes up quite a bit, actually. And with the broader phenotype, the monozygotic twin concordance is up to 90%. The recurrence risk in siblings is about 10%. It does vary a little bit based on the study you read. The largest study actually looking at infant siblings of children with autism followed prospectively reported a rate of 18%. And this percentage does change based on whether the proband or the child with autism is female or male because of the genetic loading that is thought to occur in females. If you have a sister with autism, your chance of having autism is much higher. So this infant sibling work, which again is a talk for itself, has been a line of research of tremendous interest around the world. And our center here actually does have an infant sibling study that's actually been going on since the time of Marion Sigmund 20 years ago, where we basically take babies who have an older sibling with autism and we follow them prospectively from birth to really investigate whether there might be some early behavioral or electrophysiological or biological markers that predict autism. And this graph is just from a recent JAMA paper that talked about recurrence risk. And really what you see here is that if you have a sibling with autism, the cumulative prevalence, you know, is about 10% in the population, whereas if you do not have a sibling with autism, the cumulative prevalence is about 1%. However, we now are learning much more about the fact that many children with autism actually have new mutations or de novo mutations. And that the field of genetics has really exploded, literally, in the last 5 or 10 years in our knowledge about the genetics. And again, the clinicians and the phenotypers are kind of running behind trying to figure out what do these different syndromes actually mean. You know, but we were sort of, for a long time, doing karyotype in fish where we had the resolution of millions of base pairs. And I'll get into these technologies a little bit more. The technologies have improved to using chromosomal microarray technology where we can see copy number variants as big as 50 to 100 kilobases. And now with whole exome sequencing, we can actually look at single point mutations. But this is from a review that Dan Geschwind and Brett Abrams wrote where they just give kind of a timeline of how the field of genetics has moved. And you'll see it's actually not that long ago. So 2005, we were still doing more kind of genome-wide association studies looking for common variants, and really in the last 5 years we've started studying copy number variations and now moving to whole exome sequencing. And I will say since my training, which was I finished my residency in 2007, you know, the field has completely changed in how we're actually studying these children and thinking about their genetic testing. But because it's happened so fast, that question of so what that the parents often ask is something that we're actually really thinking a lot about and figuring out ways to answer that question meaningfully. So, you know, I talked about sort of these three. I'm going to talk about these two technologies quickly and then talk about what we've learned from them. But this is more for those who don't use genetic testing kind of as commonly, but you've heard these terms used many times. So the chromosomal microarray, right? There's two kinds of microarrays mainly that are done. One is an array-based comparative genomic hybridization where basically the DNA of a child, the test child is compared to basically a normal DNA. And you can look to see if there's differences, whether there's areas that are duplicated or deleted. These technologies allow us to identify structural chromosomal variations that we consider either deletions or duplications. These little regions, copy number variations, contain lots of genes, hundreds of genes sometimes. And so now the work has been done to figure out which genes in those regions that might be duplicated or deleted are actually meaningful and pathogenic. But that's when we talk about copy number variants, that this is the technology that we're often using to diagnose that. We've now really moved to sort of whole exome sequencing, which has really been, has taken off even clinically in the last couple of years. I list the papers down there that are only published in the last year or two on whole exome sequencing, and they just keep coming and coming. A lot of the work in whole exome sequencing has been done with huge, huge populations of simplex families, meaning children with one child with autism, investigating whether there are genes that might be causative. And in whole exome sequencing, you're basically doing analysis at the level of the single base pair. And the idea is that if there's a mutation in one base pair, it might cause a loss of function mutation that causes mutations in certain important genes. And this is a nice figure from Neil et al. In 2012 that just shows basically how as we're identifying these different genes, how they might map together, right? So are there sort of functional groups of genes that are meaningful for protein synthesis and brain development? And much of the convergence in the genetics has come to the level of the synapse, really, and in synaptic integrity and function. So based on all of this we know that, I was listening to the beep, so more than 20% of individuals with autism have an identifiable genetic cause for their autism. And I will say that this number increases. If I give this talk in a year, that number will probably be greater, and I would say probably 20% is a conservative estimate, right? So we know about these single gene disorders that cause autism or are associated with autism, like tuberous sclerosis, Fragile X, Rett syndrome, and then the P10 related mutations, of which actually are quite interesting because they're very highly associated with both macrocephaly and macrosomia. So in a child with macrocephaly, the chance of having a P10 mutation is actually quite high, up to 17%. And then we've learned about all of these new de novo copy number variants and gene mutations. And within, again, those copy number variants, we've identified hundreds of genes. But where the field is now moving is thinking about, in these children with these copy number variants, what is the syndrome? What does the autism really look like? And I'll get to that piece in a minute, but just to highlight for you now, and this is sort of a cartoon version of a set of recommendations that that is in that review that I just mentioned, but basically now the American Academy of Medical Genetics, American College of Medical Genetics, last year published new guidelines recommending genetic testing for children with autism. And I'll emphasize that genetic testing is the only routinely warranted medical workup for children with autism. This does not mean that children do not need to undergo an EEG or an MRI if it's clinically indicated, because it sometimes absolutely is. But genetic testing is recommended across the board for all children with an autism spectrum disorder. And this is really in the wake of our knowledge about these different copy number variants and genetic syndromes associated with autism. So to walk you through this really quickly, the recommended genetic testing is that every child should undergo a chromosomal microarray, regardless of phenotype, regardless of presentation. And then there's more phenotype-specific testing recommended. So in males, Fragile X testing should be performed. In females, MECP2 sequencing for Rett syndrome or Rett variants. And then if the child has macrocephaly, which is not subtle, it's not a child with a slightly large head, it's a child with a head that's more than 2.5 standard deviations above the norm. In those children, P10 gene sequencing analysis should be performed. And then, of course, really careful and comprehensive genetic counseling. So the way, just to give you a quick aside to this, the way that I handle testing for genetics in my clinic, because I evaluate many children with not just autism, but comorbid neurological sequelae and issues like epilepsy, where the rate of having a genetic variant is even higher. In those children, I do a careful assessment, and then I actually refer them to my genetics colleagues here. Sorry, Julian, your numbers might now quadruple, but I send them all to Julian, actually, Martinez, and what they will do is do a quick evaluation as well, and then actually order the testing. And the reason we do it that way is that, A, it provides a really nice mechanism for follow-up, so that the patients can actually then receive genetic counseling as needed, because parents need genetic counseling even if their test is normal because of the recurrence risks I described earlier, right? So a parent who has one child with autism and the child is negative, it does not mean that they don't have an increased risk to have a second child with an autism spectrum disorder. So I think the genetic counseling is really key. It's also key because if there is a variant of known or unknown significance, then there's a whole protocol in place after that. So the parents will get tested to determine determine whether it is, in fact, a new mutation or not. And then if the variant is still of unclear significance, the team will go on to exome sequencing to really identify which genes are implicated. It also allows us to sort of also think more academically about what these different rare variants might actually mean. And so I find it really useful that these patients are seen by genetics. And now, because of these guidelines, insurance companies are catching up. And so our children are not, and families are not stuck with a bill for thousands of dollars for this testing anymore. It is covered by most insurances. And if not, the genetics folks have really good letters that help get things covered. So that's another reason to send them to genetics. So thus far, most of the sort of the phenotyping efforts, if you will, the clinical phenotyping efforts in these genetic syndromes, and I'm talking not only about the single gene disorders, but in these rare variants, is really has been focused so far on kind of symptom constellations, which is a good start, but I think we need to now start moving forward from that. And what we know is that children with known variants that are causative for autism definitely have some of these other comorbidities. And that's why a lot of these kids fall into the lap of child neurology. At times, intellectual disability is much more common in these high-risk syndromes. Epilepsy is more common. Motor delays and impairment are more common, and we'll talk about that in our examples that I give you later. Psychiatric comorbidities are more common. Many of these children have specific dysmorphologies that can help clue into the diagnosis. And then again, macro or microcephaly. This was a really nice paper that came out earlier this year that actually described children from the Simon Simplex which is a group of patients, thousands and thousands of children that have been collected by funding from the Simons Foundation, and they're all simplex families, so families with one child with autism. And very, very extensive genetic testing has been done with these children and phenotyping to really understand what are some profiles that might be emerging. And one of the main things that they found was that intellectual disability was more common. So this is just all the blue is boys and the red is girls. And these are children, all of whom have autism in this Simons group. And you see that the average IQ here is about 90. And as you all know, the average IQ based on standardized testing should be about 100, if not a little bit higher. And in girls, it's shifted even down a little bit further. So intellectual disability is definitely a comorbidity, and it's something we have to really think about when we talk about how we diagnose autism in these children. This is another sort of, you're not meant to memorize or even read this in detail, but this is just an example of the visual is what I want, the effect is what I want here, but an example of how people are looking at symptom clusters in these various syndromes. This is another really nice paper recently came out that talked about some of the sort of syndromic autisms, if you will, meaning children who have known genetic syndromes, okay? And what they tried to do was really spell out what do these kids look like based on the variant, but they focused on epilepsy, intellectual disability, and the other is really kind of comorbid psychiatric or medical issues. And again, this is a really important start, and it definitely gives us a clue when we see a child in terms of whether our likelihood, our pretest probability that this child will have a genetic variant is high or not. So it helps us from that standpoint. Does this really help us target behavioral interventions? Probably not quite so much. And that's where I'm going to sort of head in my two examples. But again, you'll see these kinds of tables in basically every, if you PubMed autism genetics, you'll get hundreds of papers with tables like this, with just the variants in our description of what these kids really look like. But as I said, we really want to move beyond symptom clusters, right? We want to start thinking about what are the characteristics of the social communication deficits found in these variants and syndromes? And really, are there syndrome-specific developmental and behavioral features that help define their autism, particularly in the context of their intellectual disability? Because I think the answers to these questions will guide the design and implementation of targeted interventions that will work, of course, in conjunction with all of the molecular targets that we are working on in the field, particularly as we identify the actual genes that are implicated in some of these syndromes. So what I'm going to say in the next part of this talk is not to at all preclude or undermine the importance of these molecular targets. Okay, and I'm doing well time-wise, amazing. So we're going to talk now from sort of principle to practice, and I can't say that I at all have even started answering some of the sort of conundrums that I bring up in the earlier part of the talk, but I want to show you efforts that we are making in two specific disorders, again, and I want you to think about these disorders wearing the hat of what might be some developmental and clinical phenotypes in these groups that help us think about targeted behavioral interventions. So I'm going to first start with talking about tuberous sclerosis complex, which is a study that's dear to my, a population that's very dear to my heart. And I've been studying this population since I was a fellow actually in Boston, where I had some funding to investigate sort of early markers of autism in this sample. And then when I moved here, Dr. Joyce Wu and I wrote a grant to the Department of Defense to really do a study that was kind of outside the box. And I'll tell you about that in a minute. But just to remind you about TSC. So TSC is, as you know, an autosomal dominant disorder. It's caused by a loss of function of these TSC1 and 2 genes, which code for these proteins here that are really important in this sort of, you know, the ubiquitous mTOR pathway, which I'm sure many of you hear about in your in other lectures or studies about autism genetics, or really the genetics of neurodevelopmental disorders. So the mTOR pathway is really critical for regulating cell size and cell growth. And so when the TSC1, 2 complex is essentially not working, you have this, there's no stop to that mTOR pathway. And so you get an upregulation of cell growth and proliferation, which leads to actually many of these benign tumors that we talk about in TSC. Now, I will highlight that here, rapamycin is a drug that actually is an mTOR inhibitor. In fact, mTOR stands for mammalian target of rapamycin. And so, as you can imagine, rapamycin provides a really interesting target in terms of a pharmacological agent that might help stop that process of over-mTOR activity. And there's a tremendous amount of work around the world really being done on studying the effect of mTOR inhibitors on outcomes in children with tuberous sclerosis. A lot of that work is done here at UCLA by Joyce Wu and others. And so far, there's been actually some nice success with mTOR inhibitors in shrinking the size of some of the subependymal giant cell astrocytomas and possibly helping with the cutaneous lesions. And now there's studies underway to see if mTOR inhibitors might be able to help some of the cognitive deficits seen in TSC. That gets a little trickier, though, because a lot of these cognitive deficits that we see, as I'll show you in a minute, are presenting very early in life. And so the key is, when do we want to target these children with these sorts of treatments, especially when they're not entirely benign, right? This is an immunosuppressant. So children definitely have a lot of side effects with these medications. So really the goal ultimately is to use these agents in conjunction with informed behavioral interventions to help improve outcomes. So in addition to sort of these benign tumors that we all know about with tuberous sclerosis, there's also been shown to be aberrant connectivity throughout the cortex. And there's been particular interest, and I bring this up because it sort of set the stage for the work we are doing in this population. There's particularly been shown to be aberrant connectivity in visual cortex. And this is sort of a pretty slide from a colleague of mine, Dr. Mustafa Sahin in Boston, who has done a lot of work investigating the structural abnormalities in TSC mouse models. And this is the lateral geniculate nucleus, and this is looking at basically contralateral cortical visual projections. And what you see in the TSC2 mouse is that, in the heterozygous mouse, is that there's quite a bit of sort of disorganization and almost exuberance at overgrowth of these contralateral projections compared to that wild-type mouse. So we became really interested in that because we thought, if that's the case and there's really aberrant connectivity in visual projections, how would that affect visual function and maybe higher level visual functions like social interaction, right? And so we sort of thought about this in the framework of the work I'll present. But as I'm sure many of you know, TSC does confer a high risk for autism, intellectual disability, and epilepsy. So about 50% of children with TSC have a diagnosis of autism. So the studies in autism thus far in TSC have really focused mostly cross-sectionally on characterizing children after they have a diagnosis. Most of them are in older children and adolescents and adults. And so again, it's been mostly focused on, as I described earlier, kind of symptom clusters, right? And what we know is that in children with autism and TSC, there's a higher rate of cognitive impairment, Earlier onset and more severe seizures and infantile spasms, and the presence of tubers. There's a lot of excitement for a while in the field about location of tubers and how those might relate to autism. Temporal lobe tubers, because that's sort of where a lot of social cognition, if you will, like face processing is generated, was an area of interest. But really, we moved away from that sort of somewhat, I don't want to say simplistic, but somewhat reductionistic kind of explanation that it was just about tuber location. A couple of years ago, we did a study actually looking at investigating face processing using EEG and found that there was atypical face processing in children with tuber sclerosis, and it was more impaired, if you will, in children with autism and TSC. The other piece about the autism and TSC that makes this population really intriguing to study is that, as you know, infants with TSC are often diagnosed before they're born, right? So they're diagnosed either because they have, this is a in utero MRI showing the subependymal giant cell astrocytoma in the ventricle, or they're diagnosed because they have cardiac rhabdomyomas that are picked up on ultrasound, right? So we have an opportunity here. We know that these infants have TSC before they're born. So we thought, why not follow them prospectively the way we have been with infant siblings? And so that's when we wrote this grant that the Department of Defense generously funded to basically study these children prospectively. So we drew from the model of the prospective infant sibling studies, right? But we focused in on what we thought might be going on specific in TSC. And we performed actually the first longitudinal study investigating pathways to and predictors of autism in infants with TSC. And this is work in collaboration with colleagues at Boston Children's Hospital, because as you know, TSC is also rare. And you need to have a sample that is large enough that you can start making some conclusions. And so this is a multi-site study that is actually in its last year now. And our goals were to characterize developmental trajectories in children in TSC overall. So we weren't just focused on autism, although that was one of the main outcome measures we were interested in. We wanted to define early clinical, behavioral, and biological markers of autism in TSC. And we wanted to understand the developmental and behavioral profiles of autism in children with TSC. And the goal here, why are we doing this work? Well, it's interesting academically, but also the goal here is that if we can identify some early predictors or some trajectories, we can that put children at risk. We can then start thinking about targeted interventions at the right time, which probably is earlier than the time that they're diagnosed with autism. And we're working under a very simple kind of schematic. Again, this is very oversimplified, but I just want to give you a sense of how we think about studies like this when we design them. And the idea here is that if there really is aberrancy in the axonal integrity and visual cortex and projections, this might actually affect not only low-level visual processing, but also the visual processing of social information, which is key, we know, in the early development of social cognition. And with this, I mean mainly faces, right? So if there's some atypicality in processing visual information, that might affect how children actually process and learn from social stimuli that are presented to them, which then can absolutely impair visual attention and social engagement and predispose children to autism. Now, again, I wish the story were that simple, but at least it gives us a framework so we're not throwing the kitchen sink at these kids, because these are not easy children to study, and we cannot do a phenotyping battery of 1 week to gather the data we might want. So we have to be targeted. And so the study design is, as I said, these children are followed longitudinally at two sites, and I won't go into the details of all the assessments, but they undergo clinical EEG as well as sort of a research EEG that I'll show you an example of, a neurologic examination. In Boston, they undergo MRI imaging, and then we do targeted yet comprehensive developmental testing at every age. And we're very interested in both kind of early cognition, both verbal and nonverbal, as well as evidence of sort of social communication function. And the event-related EEG work that I'll show you is done in my lab, and we have a rich history of doing this in autism as a whole, but we basically collect data from 128 electrodes. What's nice about it is that it's a net that goes on their head, so it's much easier to put on. And the child basically can look at different stimuli, and we can, through processing of the data, quantify in real time how a child actually processes information. So with temporal resolution of milliseconds, we can find out about if a child is typically processing low-level visual information, faces, if they're learning from pattern learning paradigms, those sorts of things. Okay, and we do a lot of painstaking work to get these kids to wear this net. We do a lot of desensitization and visual schedules and things like that. We have training nets that we send home. So it's quite a bit of work, but hopefully with some benefits in the end. And if any of you are interested in seeing this sort of work that we do, you're welcome to come visit the lab. So I'm going to present just the results from the first sort of set of analyses, because this really shows kind of the steps we're taking into thinking about these specific phenotypes. And this was published in Neurology earlier this year. But essentially, we in our sample as a whole, just to describe it, 95% of our children did have an epilepsy diagnosis. Not particularly surprising, because these are all children who are basically diagnosed with TSC in the first year of life. Most of our sample was starting at 12 months and up. Recruitment was a little bit harder in the first year, but I do have some data in the first year as well. They all had tubers. And in terms of the rate of ASD, it actually was consistent with the literature. About 55% of our children met criteria for ASD. But again, I'm going to put that in quotes, because I think that the way we diagnosed ASD was using a standardized measure called the ADOS, the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule, as well as best clinical estimate. But the intellectual disability piece definitely makes that diagnosis a little trickier. So here's some of the behavioral data. And again, this is all published, so you can I can refer you to the paper later if you would like. By 6 months of age, and this is when we found these results, I thought, oh my gosh, my model actually maybe works. Who would have thought, right? But it's probably still not that simple. But by age 6 months, our infants with TSC are actually showing delays specific to the nonverbal domain, right? So this is, blue is controls, red is TSC, and this is all our babies now. We're not, especially in the first year, we don't have a sample to really make statistics. Statistical value of ASD versus not. And again, just so you understand, you know, the kids are followed all the way through. So I'm describing the whole group looking retrospectively at the longitudinally collected data. But these are all kids who have reached at least 24 months to have an outcome. Okay, so, and when we really looked at this more deeply using a scale that we're running with these children at every age called the AOC, which is the Autism Observation Schedule of Infancy, and it's a play-based measure where an examiner, and it's been developed by someone named Lonnie Zweigenbaum in Ottawa and is now well-validated. It's basically a play-based measure where we evaluate simple social communication abilities in babies. And in the AOC, the places that we see the delays or the differences from typical development are in visually mediated behaviors. So we see it in visual tracking, in visual disengagement, and in this anticipatory response is also a visual task. We don't see it in social babbling or orienting to name. So quite interesting, right? Now, it doesn't stay this way. And by 1 year of life, the children actually with TSC show delays across the board. But in that first year, we're getting a glimpse that there may be something here that is worth targeting, that maybe we have something that's laying a deficit, that's laying a foundation. So by 12 months of age, our children with TSC as a whole are more delayed than our typically developing kids. And now this graphic is actually now showing you autism versus not. So by 12 months, we actually had a nice enough sample size that we could actually pull out the children who developed autism. And we wanted to examine developmental trajectories, as I said, and to think about what might be predictors, developmental predictors of developing or being diagnosed with autism. And so I'll walk you through this a little bit. So what we find, so the green line is children who do not go on to develop autism. And the red line is children who do develop autism. And this is age. So this is 12 months to 36 months. And this is nonverbal IQ and verbal IQ. And really nonverbal, you might ask, what is a verbal IQ and a nonverbal IQ in a 12-month-old? Well, there is one actually. And the nonverbal IQ is really based on visual reception skills and some fine motor behaviors, whereas verbal IQ is expressive and receptive language. So what we did, we worked with these unbelievable statisticians here to think about how to model this, given that there's other variables that we care about, like epilepsy. So we were able to actually control for seizure severity, and we, Joyce and I, sort of developed a seizure severity rating, essentially. And controlling for that, if we can, we find significant differences, not only in verbal and nonverbal IQ at 12 months, between children who develop autism and who don't. So meaning children who develop autism are more delayed, but more importantly, certainly possibly, we find a significant decline in nonverbal IQ in the children who go on to have autism. Now, decline does not mean they're losing skills. It means that they're basically moving farther away from the norm. They're failing to achieve normal milestones at a sort of faster rate, if you will, than the children who do not go on to have autism. Another important interaction that came out, though, is in the children with autism, there was a significant interaction between nonverbal IQ and the nonverbal IQ slope and seizures, meaning that it seems that the children who go on to have autism might be more vulnerable to their epilepsy, which might in part be contributing to that decline in slope. And I just want to bring up the fact that I scoured the literature when we found this finding in the infant sibling world, right? So in the other high-risk groups that we study. This decline specific to nonverbal IQ is very unique. It has not been reported in any other longitudinal high-risk sample. And this is just to show you one large study of infant siblings, which tracked developmental trajectories. And they did identify one group that they called a developmental slowing group that also had that decline moving away from norm. But that was an all domains. It was not specific to nonverbal IQ. So we might have sort of established or identified a distinctive developmental trajectory. Right. So now, thinking about that schematic I showed you a minute ago, you might think, well, what about the earlier domains? What about low-level visual processing? What about face processing? And these are the data that we're actually actively going through now. We actually found, and how do we look at low-level processing quickly? We show children a pattern reversal checkerboard while they're wearing the EEG net. And we can look in real time as to how their occipital cortex responds to that low-level visual stimulus. This is a very well-established, well-published paradigm. And we found, to our great surprise, but we were very happy about the finding for the sake of the children, that we found very much intact and robust visual evoked potentials in these kids. And yes, all our kids actually look this happy when they come to the lab. But you know, this P1 that you see that's generated occipitally is robust and actually exactly the same in children with TSC compared to our children with typical development. And you can see here just the range in the kids. There's a little bit more heterogeneity in the TSC sample, and as we get more data that allow us to sort of think about subgroups, we might still be able to think about some differences, individual differences. However, we did find atypical face processing, and this is in the group as a whole. This is not pulled out by these groups are not made based on autism diagnosis. So in the interest of time, I won't go into excruciating detail about the paradigm, but we show babies pictures of mom or dad, their primary caregiver, a stranger, and then objects. And what we want to look to see is, do they differentiate familiar, unfamiliar, and do they have a differential response to faces and objects? And this is based on a very rich literature in typical infancy. We know exactly what babies are supposed to do with paradigms like this. They're supposed to have a differential response to familiar, unfamiliar in the first 2 years of life. And what we find, this y-axis is basically the difference score. So it's the difference between familiar, unfamiliar. And what we see is that at 12, 18, and 24 months, our infants with TSC are not really differentiating familiar, unfamiliar the way our typically developing kids are. And this is actually work that we've just now finished analyzing and are getting ready for submission. But it's quite striking, right? And so this is, again, a possible biological phenotype that might relate to their social communication deficits. So, you know, we've shown that there's probably intact low-level processing, yet there may be some impairments here in the visual processing of social information, which then might lead to deficits in social cognition. And I'll just quickly say that, you know, one thing I showed you is that the children who go on to have autism are more delayed. And I think this question, can we really disentangle it from intellectual disability? I don't have an answer for it completely yet, but I just want to raise it because we have to think about it. We looked at our sample to see, did any kids have high-functioning autism in our group? And actually, none of them did. There were 3 kids who had intellectual disability who did not meet criteria for ASD. And these are sort of just descriptions of those kids. And you'll see, it's not that they had completely intact social communication skills. Right? They did have some areas of impairment. So will these kids actually meet criteria when they get a little older? Possibly. But I bring this up for the clinicians in the room just to sort of think about this conundrum we still face. So to summarize those findings, we know that early delays in visually mediated behaviors followed by a decline in nonverbal IQ and autism suggest that deficits in nonverbal communication may compromise the development of typical social behavior. And You know, I think that this issue of overlapping with the overlap with cognitive impairment still needs further exploration. But again, think about that nonverbal communication domain, right? Because we thought about it and we thought, well, this might give us an opportunity for early intervention. And this is where we are now. And we just have applied for quite a bit of funding to study this and have already received some funding to start doing this work. And so we have actually started piloting a targeted early intervention in infants with tuberous sclerosis using an intervention model developed by Connie Castery here at UCLA called JASPER, which stands for Joint Attention Symbolic Play Engagement Regulation. It's basically an intervention that targets nonverbal communication. And we've done a little bit of modifying to it to make it more appropriate for our infants with TSC. But the idea is that we will be studying infants with tuberous sclerosis at that age where we're already seeing differences at 12 months, right? So where we already see the ASD and non-ASD difference. And we're enrolling them in an early intervention that targets nonverbal communication. We've already actually piloted two children just really to establish some feasibility. And what's really nice is what we show, and again, you can always make graphs like this that make it look like kids make huge gains, and I acknowledge that. We haven't cured autism by any means. But in our two toddlers that have actually already been enrolled in JASPER, we looked at specifically at nonverbal communication behaviors, initiation of joint attention, behavior regulation, and response to joint attention. And the children our one child made really nice gains. Our second toddler actually had some variable effects. And so one of the questions is, are there actually some predictors of who will respond to this kind of intervention? But for you, I want the take-home point to be here that we're targeting an intervention that's targeting a domain that we have shown to be delayed specifically in this group. Okay, so perfect timing, because for the next sort of 5 minutes, I'll talk to you about the second population we're studying with the same framework in mind, although this is much newer work that's being done. And this is the example I give you here is a copy number variant syndrome that we call DUP15Q syndrome. This was not even a syndrome 10 years ago because we weren't doing microarray analyses on most children with autism, but now it's a syndrome, and we have hundreds of kids around the country with this variant. So DUP15Q syndrome is based on having duplications in the 15Q region that actually is also deleted in Angelman and Prader-Willi. And I won't go into the genetics at all in details, but basically in that region are many GABA receptor genes. And so these children definitely are at high risk for epilepsy as well. It is actually now thought to be the most common copy number variant associated with autism. And the number of children that we know have this is growing exponentially as the testing is done. There's two main types. There's the full duplication with an extra piece of chromosome called isodicentric duplication, and then there's a duplication that happens within the region itself called interstitial. And thus far in the field, looking at these children, because they were so rare and the testing wasn't being done, most of the studies, again, focused on symptom clusters. And these are just sort of snapshots of two papers that really looked at symptom clusters in these patients. And what really was described is kind of nonspecific. It's what we know is the case in lots of genetic syndromes, right? Intellectual disability, profound motor delays, language delay, sleep impairment. Now, there's one area that I won't get into today that's really intriguing for me as an electrophysiologist, which is that they have this signature of excessive beta activity on their EEG. Not all, but some. It looks like they're taking benzodiazepines. And it's likely related to that GABA, those GABA genes in that region, and probably upregulation of some of those genes. And we're actually right now quantifying that in the lab. And this is an example of that excessive beta activity that we see on the EEG. But we wanted to move beyond the symptom clusters. As I started seeing many of these patients in my clinic, and I'll show you a slide in a minute, but we've actually established in the last year one of the national DUP15Q clinics here at UCLA. And so I've seen about 25 children in the last year with this syndrome, and they're more coming weekly, actually. But the question again was, what is the social communication phenotype here? Are there some common features? Because parents would come to me in clinic and say, okay, so my child has this variant. I know they're at risk for epilepsy. What's the right treatment, right? Should they get ABA? Should they get more play-based treatment? What should we be doing? And so in an effort to really understand this, we have been combining forces, right? With rare disorders, you have to combine forces. And now there's national clinics for DUP15Q. We're one of the newest ones. They're all over the world, all over the country. And we meet as a group once a month and talk about our patients and talk about not only collaborative research studies, but also clinical phenotyping studies. And so we just got funding to start a study looking at social communication function and cognition in children with DUP15Q. And the goal here, again, is to pilot them into intervention that might target their needs. We do a really comprehensive battery because in these children, unlike TSC, we didn't enter it with a clear sense of we think this is going to be the area of impairment. So we do a very comprehensive two-day battery with these kids. So actually, in the last 6 months, we've actually already studied seven children completely, which is actually the biggest sample of deep phenotyping in this population. And there are some sort of nice trends we've already found. So I will say that all of our children, except for one, met criteria for ASD on the ADOS itself, right? But there's a big but there because they have quite a few delays in other areas as well. I'm going to show you a quick clip for 30 seconds of one of our children, and I want you just to think about kind of his presentation, because I watch him in the eyes of someone who sees a lot of autism. So this kiddo is 3 years old, and he came to me with a diagnosis of autism already.
Okay. Ready?
So I'll talk over it while you're watching him. What he does is, you can see his motor impairment, right? So he's definitely a little unsteady and his tone is low when you examine him. When she gives him different presses on the ADOS.
Does he have any stuffed animals at home?
He will redirect and go towards her, right? But do you notice that he never makes eye contact? He actually never looks up, right? He's very focused on the things that are sort of around him. And he engages in this repetitive behavior.
I also noticed that he tends to spin or drop some of the toys.
Yeah, he's repeatedly.
Okay. But he is showing some pleasure in that. And then fast forward a little bit, when she starts blowing bubbles.
Go get it! Pop, pop.
He's still quite stuck on that.
What do you think?
But then he'll redirect. The second she takes it away, he'll go over. But look at the way he's engaging with that room and with her. He's looking straight down. But when she starts blowing bubbles, he will engage a little bit with her.
Pop, you too. What do you think?
He's very interested, object focused, right? So he represented actually a lot of what we see in these kids, and we see older ones too, which is that their motor deficits seem to really impair all of their areas of functioning. This kid literally, and we've actually started doing some pilot work with him in intervention already, he actually doesn't look up and make eye contact ever because he almost cannot, right? So his motor deficits preclude him in attending to others, which absolutely, I'm sure, earlier in development affected his social learning, right? And the motor impairment also is seen in their language profile. So their expressive language is more delayed than their receptive. They understand, but they have trouble actually making the words. So the item on every child that we did an ADOS on, the consistent items that were missed were eye contact and initiating joint attention, right, which is what you saw in this child. But responding to bids of joint attention was consistently achieved, which is actually very rare for children with autism. So we're seeing a profile here that's actually seems to be rooted in the fact that there seems to be social interest, but almost an inability to interact. Right? They don't know how. They actually motorically cannot. And it's clear that some of the standardized testing we've been doing in the past maybe doesn't quite capture that subtlety. And I want you to think about that because that's how we are trying to look at these children. And so we actually are just completing the phenotyping here in Southern California. And actually that phenotyping battery that we're doing here is being extended to all of the sites around the country. And I will say this same child has been placed in an intervention that what we're doing is we're targeting his motor skills and we're targeting eye contact. And we're using an iPad to help him communicate. And you see that his engagement after intervention has gone up significantly after a month. Okay, and this is, again, very pilot data. And so now I am done. I'm just going to give you my summary slide. So as you know, as I hope I've sort of helped you think about today, genetic testing for autism is not just academic. ASD is heritable. While the clinical studies in genetic syndromes have mostly focused on the identification of common symptom clusters, we really need to focus on deeper behavioral and developmental phenotyping in these syndromes. And we need multidisciplinary efforts to do this. And I'll just leave the slide up as my last slide. We're actually now now in conjunction with Dr. Martinez in genetics, Dr. Bearden in psychology, and Dr. Mehta in psychiatry, actually established a developmental neurogenetics clinic funded by the Department of Psychiatry. We go live next year, so it hasn't quite happened yet. But the idea is that all of these children with known variants or syndromes and a neurodevelopmental disorder, doesn't have to be autism, will all be phenotyped. They'll have a clinical home, and we'll do phenotyping in a standardized way across these syndromes to start then being able to target interventions for these different high-risk groups. And I will leave there. Sorry, I left you 2 minutes for questions. So,
you've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.